let's have a meeting. My name is Tinsley and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Now, tonight's speaker is a guy that, to a lot of us, needs no introduction, but I love hearing him tell his story. It's all solution, and I come to these rooms for solution to my problem, not to hear people gripe or tell war stories, but I hope he tells a few of his war stories. And as a side note, this is the man that took me through the steps, and he truly saved my life. And except for my dad, who recently passed away, I would say this man is the most influential man in my life. So with that, I give you Bill.
Good evening, everybody. Tinsley, thanks for the kind words. I'm Bill Barnes. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 21st, 1993. It's great to be back at NABA. The guy that I asked to be my, I guess he was my fourth sponsor, was the guy that I actually worked the steps with. And I'll talk a lot more about sponsorship in a little while, but I'd been in the rooms for a few months, and I'd asked some guys to sponsor me, and I was ready to work steps, and they weren't. So I kept switching, and through the big boy upstairs, I was at a men's workshop called Rock Eagle, and I had known this guy from 10 years earlier, and he came up and tapped on my shoulder, and it was my friend from 10 years ago, and he had 3.5 years sober, long term sobriety, and that was an eternity to me at the time. So, and he came here. He was a regular here. I think it was the 9:30 everyday meeting here. His name was Lawrence Potts. Unfortunately, he's passed on, but. Lawrence was a great guy. I was attracted to him for a number of reasons. One is it was obvious when I looked around at what he was doing, and he was also successful in business, and that was an attraction to me. And so, I would come to meetings here to meet with him, and one of the things I remember the most about him is that he had a great sense of humor, and he would always talk solution. But in every time he would share, which was just about every meeting, he would always, even though he had a great sense of humor, he would always say this during his sharing. He would say, "You know, this is serious business." And I'll never forget him for that, because this is serious business. Again, we have a great time around here, and one of the things I'll talk about later is learning how to have fun sober. It's a big deal in recovery. A lot of people struggle with it, but there it is. So the book talks about what it was like, what we did, and what it's like now. And I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on what it was like, because if you're sitting in this room, you know what it was like. You lived it. So I'm just going to qualify myself a little bit, and then I want to talk a lot about what I've been taught here, which I've been told to call the solution. And so I was a late bloomer. I didn't start really drinking until I was 18. I know there are people probably sitting here that can tell their story. They started when they were 5, you know, but I wasn't one of those. And I started, but I made up for lost time. So I discovered the typical thing we hear in an alcoholic story, because it's true most of us, that when I discovered my first drinks, I had that warm feeling inside, and I became a part of, and I felt like I had a community. Later did I come to understand that, well, it was a using community and not a real, true, quality friendship community. But I couldn't see that, because I have a disease called alcoholism. And it's a peculiar disease. It's got peculiar thinking involved. Really, I'm going to be brief on this. Over a 20-year period, I was out there from 18 when I was 40. I burned 3 marriages down. And I ended up, I truly respect the singleness of purpose here, but part of my story is some outside issues. So I will talk about those, and I hope that wouldn't offend anybody. And just my humble opinion is a drug is a drug is a drug. Alcohol is a drug, cocaine is a drug, marijuana is a drug, whatever. They're all drugs. And I drank and drugged to change the way I felt. And it worked for some period of time, until it didn't. And so over that 20-year period, I look back on this, and we don't see this stuff when we're in the middle of it, but first marriage, I dated her for a year. We were married for 3 years. Subconsciously, I was in my disease. I knew that I couldn't continue doing what I was doing and wanted to do, so I divorced her. A few months later, I met another girl. I dated her for a year. I was married to her for 3 years. At some point in that, I knew I couldn't keep doing what I wanted to do, so I divorced her. Some period goes by. I meet another girl. I date her for a year. I get married. I date her for 3 years, except this one's a little different. At the end of that, she was a reasonably healthy girl. And when you don't show up for 2 or 3 days in the time over and over again, wives don't typically like that. So she had never said over the last year of my using and drinking that if you do this again, I'm leaving you. When I look back on it, she was saying those things in different ways. I just couldn't hear them. So my modus operandi would be I would stay clean for a little while, and then I would go out and blow it out for overnight. And I would stay out purposely till the time she had to go to work. So she'd go to work, and now I would come in, and then I would sleep it off. And then all I was looking for when she came home was, am I in trouble? Okay. Well, this final time, she came home. I stayed out all night. She went to work, came home, and she had been to see a counselor that day. And she said, Bill, this is a quote. She said, Bill, I still love you, but you have killed the in love with you. I'm out of here. So that was for those that have been in relationships, it's a lot easier to leave somebody than it is to be left. It feels way different. And so what I failed to mention is 10 years before that, I had gone into a treatment center here in Atlanta called Ridgeview for the 28-day program, and I just didn't get it. I know they took me to AA meetings, might even come here. But I just didn't, maybe took us to 2 or 3 meetings over 28 days, and that just, nothing clicked. So I'd been out there for 10 more years. So when she said, I'm out of here, I knew I had a problem, but no clue of what to do about it. So I white-knuckled it for a week. And then I woke up one morning, being a good alcohol and drug addict that I am, and said, what am I staying sober for? I'm probably a drug addict and alcoholic. I am broke. My third wife has left me. My life's over. So I got on a plane with some credit cards and a little bit of money and some other people's money and went to the Caribbean, and I drank Jack Daniels and shot cocaine for 48 straight days. So I've earned a seat here. Through the grace of the higher power I choose to call God, I ended up back here in a treatment center called Mar around the corner. And with all the feelings of I'm a bad guy, all you have to do is look at the things that I have done to, I never said to myself consciously, I'm a bad guy. But inside, I felt that low self-esteem and low self-respect that we show up here with. And I was very fortunate that I was in a good treatment center, and they taught me the disease concept, which is the realization that I have a disease. When it goes untreated, I do things I would not ordinarily do. And I was talking with a friend earlier about the way that I've learned to look at this and to be self-forgiving of what I did back then was an example. If I had a really bad case of diabetes and I had gotten bad insulin for 20 years and it had reacted badly and it made me crazy, and I did a bunch of stuff like we do as alcoholics, and then I started getting some good insulin, which is what I get from coming here, and I came to my right mind. If I really had a disease called diabetes and I really got bad drugs to cure them, and it really caused me to act badly, how would I feel about that? Would I beat myself up? No, because I have a disease called that. Well, I was taught that we have a disease called alcohol and drug addiction, which is exactly the same thing as having diabetes with bad drugs. When in the throes of my disease, I will do things that I would not ordinarily do. My sponsor helped me with this early on. I was a few months clean, and he said, "Hey, Bill, are you still out there robbing, cheating, stealing, doing the stuff you did?" I said, "No." He said, "That shows me you're not a bad guy. It shows me you're a sick guy. That when we do this stuff, it's because we're out there in our disease." One of the definitions I really like of this disease is it is a disease which is fatal in nature, but when treated properly, the patient comes out better than if they had never had the disease. And I'll say that again because it's really a cool way to look at it. Alcoholism is a disease which is fatal in nature, but when treated properly with the 12 steps, the patient comes out better than if they had never had the disease. And what I mean by that is, by explanation, is I know a lot of people out there in the world that don't have a drug and alcohol problem, but they're unhappy, miserable human beings. They don't have a clue how to go through their day to start growing the four most important things that recovery has given me, which is peace, serenity, healthy self-esteem, and healthy self-respect. Didn't know those were possible. Weren't even on the radar before I got here, and they don't have any clue. But because I was a drug addict and alcoholic, and I got exposed to the 12 steps, I have a life today which is way beyond anything I ever dreamed of. So I'm in the 48th day down there, acting incredibly grandiose, trying to buy friends like we do, and I finally run out of money. I had borrowed every penny I could borrow. I'd spent every penny I spent, and somehow I had not sold my plane ticket home. And so I get on a plane and I come back, and my friends and family had found this place for me to go. Now, let's talk about treatment centers for a second. I've learned that somebody can get sober anywhere. No treatment center, a bad treatment center, and good treatment centers. If I'm willing to do the work, then I can get sober anywhere. That being said, the way I look at my treatment center is I got into a really good one, and they gave me a jump start on this. It would have taken me a while probably to learn about the disease concept and some other core issues. I hate those kind of terms, but things about me that I would want to change that I could not see. I got here with all these blind spots, things about myself that I would change if I could see them. I just couldn't see them. So I was in that, and then I look back on this, and I got blessed with the second week I was in this treatment center. A guy that was in there with me found this meeting called the Log Cabin. It was a meeting up in Norcross that's still going on today. Been around for about 30 years. We'd love to have you come join us on a Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. And I walked in the door, and they were doing the deal. While I was in that treatment center, I know none of y'all will be able to relate to this, but they had these community meetings. Anybody had to go to a community meeting in a halfway house? Okay. And what the community meeting is, they meet once a week or twice a week, I can't remember, in the evenings. In my case, it was two apartments with 10 guys with a counselor to talk about from as minor stuff as Johnny stealing my cheese and Jimmy won't make up his bed to more serious stuff, you know. And I'd been in Myanmar for about 40 days or so. And at every meeting, they were talking about me. And I just was sick of that. So for the few days before the next meeting, I was as nice as I knew how to be to every single person in my community. So just for one meeting, they would not talk about me. They would talk about somebody else. Well, y'all know what happened. So we start the meeting. I'm feeling really good about stuff. They're not going to talk about me. And they start on one side of the room, and they start jumping in my stuff. And I'm not hearing a word of it. I'm just getting angrier and angrier and angrier. It finally gets around to the counselor, and I'm thinking, maybe he'll save me. He jumped right in. I stood up. I said, F this. I walked into the apartment next door where I was living, into my bedroom, opened the closet, pulled my suitcase out, threw it on the bed, threw the suitcase open, and said to myself, I don't have anywhere to go. And I am grateful I didn't. So I sat on the stoop until the meeting was over, and I'm very thankful they didn't just kick me out over that. And so here's when I really believe my recovery started, is I that night pulled each person that was in my community one at a time back out on the back veranda. And I said, what am I doing wrong? And here's the key phrase from that. At that point, I had enough pain to where I became willing to hear what I did not want to hear about me. Before recovery, if you had said, hey, Bill, you might want to look at you don't tell the truth all the time, or hey, you don't show up on time, you don't respect other people's time, I would have made it about you. I would have said, why don't you look at your own damn self, for it takes one to know one. And I would not even looked inside to say, wasn't capable before that of looking inside to saying, well, maybe I don't, do I not tell the truth, or do I not respect people's time? So I became willing to hear what I didn't want to hear, and I took each person individually out on the back veranda and asked them. And amazing to me, but not amazing looking back on it, each one of them said basically the same stuff that I was doing wrong. They could see my blind spots. And I was willing to hear what I didn't want to hear. And based on those conversations, I started making changes. Because what, you know, I always talk about that all recovery is a change in perspective. I'll say that again. All recovery is a change in perspective. The world out there is not going to change. My wife's going to be who she's going to be. My job's going to be what it's going to be. Traffic, my hard one, is going to be what it's going to be. So if I want to have some peace and contentment and healthy self-esteem and healthy self-respect, what needs to change? If that stuff's not going to change, what's got to change? Me and the way I look at that stuff. Also, early in recovery, how I look at myself. And how I behave towards myself and how I behave towards everything else. There's the change in perspective. So what these 12 steps are brilliant at doing is helping me with that. So based on their perspectives and my willingness to hear them, I started making changes in myself for the better. And things started getting better. The next meeting, I don't really remember this accurately, but I seem to kind of remember they didn't talk about me next meeting, which would have been okay. Except I do remember raising my hand at the first of the meeting after what had happened the week before. And I said, guys, I know it's not going to feel good. I call it zingers, things about myself that don't feel good. I know it's not going to feel good, but if you see me doing stuff that you want to point it out, please do, because I saw the value in it. So I started making those changes. And then I found the log cabin. And what was special about that, and NABA's the same way, is there were a bunch of people doing the deal. I walked up on the front area out front of the meeting, and there were people laughing, and they were talking about what they were doing for fun, and they had relationships and stuff, and I was immediately attracted. The book talks about attraction, not promotion, and I was attracted to this. So I started going every time the door was open. And started listening to what you guys were saying. And here's kind of what happened. And those that know me know I try to keep things simple, because I'll complicate anything. And so when I looked back over the things that I did, and this is an action program, I can't change the way I think without changing how I behave. I can't think my way into sober behavior. I have to behave my way into sober thinking. And so what I distilled down to things that were a recipe for getting sober and a recipe for continued sobriety, I call them the six things. And I'm going to go through them quickly, and then I'm going to come back and break them down and why they were important to me. There, first one is to go to meetings. Second is get a competent sponsor. Third, work all 12 steps. Four, learn to pray. Five is work with others. And six is learn how to have fun sober. Okay, so we go to meetings. This is where I hear people who are doing the deal. This is the only program I know of there is proof positive that it works. Sitting in this row right here and back there, there's a couple hundred years of sobriety. You know, that's proof to me that this thing works. So if I come in here and I think, man, this stuff doesn't work, just look around. You see people who are as bad at alcoholics or worse than I was that have long-term sobriety and have lives that are really good. So I go to meetings and I listen. Those that know me, I sit on the front row every time. I don't want to miss the thing that's being said. I don't want to be distracted by the back of somebody's head. I listen. And what I was taught to do is to listen to every single person that's here, because I didn't want to miss that nugget that I might miss if I'm getting distracted looking at a phone or whatever. We didn't have phones back then, by the way. So it makes it even harder now. So I go to meetings, and y'all kept talking about sponsorship. And so I proved beyond a reasonable doubt that I could not do this sober thing by myself. If I could have fixed myself by myself, I would have done it long before I got here. So there's proof that I can't do it. The cool part is I don't have to. I've got you folks in the meetings, and I've got a sponsor and a higher power that I found once I got here to help me if I will take the action to reach out and be transparent and honest with a sponsor. A good sponsor just wants to help me. If I'm dishonest with my sponsor, if I'm not transparent with them, I'm wasting our time. If a sponsoree calls me up and his dog just died and he's talking about his hangnail, how upset he is, and he's not telling me about his dog just died, how am I going to help him with that? So, and obviously more serious stuff. So the other thing I've run into, and I'm sure I did it too, is that I call it being that guy. Whether I have a week, a month, a year, 5 years or more, when something happens, I'll think, you know, I ought to be able to handle this myself. I don't want to call my sponsor. I want him to think I'm sober. Instead of calling my sponsor up and doing what I should do, is to say, here's what I'm struggling with. Do you have experience with it? And a good sponsor is not going to give me experience he doesn't have. If he doesn't have it, he's going to send me to somebody who does. Because I guarantee you, whatever we go through in these rooms, there's somebody in these rooms that has been through it before I have successfully without using. That will help me if I will ask them. So the primary purpose of a sponsor is to work the 12 steps. What y'all taught me is this is the fellowship. This is not the program. This is the fellowship, which is a wonderful thing. The program is the 12 steps. So if I'm going to 12-step meetings and not working the 12 steps, I'm not in the program. Okay? So we get my sponsor, and a perfect sponsoree is somebody says, okay, what do you want me to do? And then I go do it. Okay, I've done that. What do you want me to do next? Instead of having my sponsor have to hold me accountable, I hold myself accountable and push him to get me through quickly but thoroughly through the steps. I hear people through the years saying, I work a step a month, or I'm marinating on my fourth step, whatever. You know, people die not getting these tools, but here's the other flip perspective on that, is I can't use these tools until I've worked the steps. I can't get the perspective from each one of them until I've done them. So I've been taught to get through them as quickly but thoroughly as possible. So that is where the magic happens, is working the 12 steps. Through working the steps, when I got here, I did not have a higher power. I mean, I guess I was my higher power, my drug of choice was my higher power. And we all know how that worked out. So I had a lot of contempt prior to investigation. as the book says. And my brother happens to be a man of the cloth, so you can imagine the conversations I had with him before I got here. And I wanted, I look back on it, I wanted nothing to do, I was exposed to higher power stuff all through my life, but I subconsciously, because I had the disease, I never wanted to get closer to that because I couldn't do what I thought I wanted to do, which was to act now, realize now, and real character defects run riot. But because I stuck around and I was willing, and there's the key thing to all of this thing called recovery is willingness. How willing am I to go to meetings? How willing am I to get a sponsor? How willing am I to do with the 12 steps? And so on and so on. I became willing to be open to the idea that there was something greater than I was. And as soon as I came to that willingness, to something greater than I was, there it was all the time. And I've learned to become dependent. Here's one of the things I like to keep simple. People make out the spiritual part of the program, and this is a spiritual program, not a religious program. You know, if people sometimes come in and they find their higher power and they choose to go to church or synagogue or wherever, that's wonderful, but that's not a requirement of this program. What is a requirement is to find something greater than I am. And I found it. And keeping it simple is, people think this is a mystical, magical thing. My higher power, which I choose to call God, gave me a free will, which is the ability to think and behave however I choose to think and behave. My higher power is not going to go, great, you now believe in me, boom, you're going to behave with honesty and kindness and all the character qualities we learn out here, and you're not going to have any character defects. He's not going to do that. So, in step three, we're making a decision to turn our thinking and our behavior over to the care of God. So how do I do that? I do it by talking to Him. There's three ways: prayer, meditation, and my favorite is I talk to God. And the example I like to give is I walk in. I'm in a halfway house. I got $5 to my name. I walk up to the Kroger store, and I buy a pack of gum, and I hand the Kroger clerk that $5, and the Kroger clerk hands me back $20 in change. Well, my addict and alcoholic thinking would be something like, man, this is great. I might even say, God gave this to me. I could sure use this. Kroger's a big store. They don't need it. You know, I could rationalize it. But if I choose to put my higher power right here on the left shoulder, so I'll reach up and I can look up here and go. So here's the simplicity of this. So I've given him the $5. They gave me $20 in change. I want to keep it. If I look up and say, God, should I give the money back? What would he say? Yeah, it's real quick. Yep, give it back. So I go from being an insane person, like in step two, which is to be a thief, to not care one thing about the cashier, whether they have to make up the drawer or not, and walk out of there being a thief, to a sane thought, which is to give the money back. Now, when I was early in recovery, I started doing that. It was still hard. You know, I might give that change back. On the way out the door, I still might be going, man, I could have used that money. You know, but an hour, a day, a week later, I could look back on that and start to grow some healthy self-esteem because, hey, I did the right thing. And what I found is that stuff builds on itself. So I've learned to become dependent on a higher power because I'm the one that benefits. I get good consequences instead of bad consequences. There were two areas, which I think are kind of familiar to folks, that I was not willing to turn over to my higher power or my sponsor early in recovery. Anybody know what those were? Finance and romance. I wanted to spend what I wanted to spend, and I wanted to sleep who I wanted to sleep with. And I kept feeling the pain of that. So finally, I had to give myself a mental trick, which I'll suggest to anybody that's having this trouble. The mental trick I had to give myself was, I said to myself, you know, if I don't like what my sponsor suggests, I still can do whatever I want to do. And that, what that did is it gave me the permission to start taking stuff to him. And here's the funny thing about good sponsorship is when I would take this stuff to him, my sponsor never told me what to do. He would make suggestions and sometimes strong suggestions, never told me what to do. But when I would take this stuff to him, what he would say to me, the perspective he would come from, would 99 times out of 100 change what I wanted to do. So there's my thinking was faulty, and he gave me a perspective where I could have a healthy outlook on it, and again, it changed what I wanted to do. So I've learned to become dependent on higher power. So the first is go to meetings. Second is get a combat sponsor. Third is work all 12 steps. Fourth is learn how to pray, which I do without fail. Third step prayer morning and night, and say a bunch of other prayers. I start out every morning reading these things called the Ponderables, which if you haven't found them, I'm happy to help you with it after the meeting. It's a compilation of great readings every morning. And then I roll on my knees and I say the third step prayer because it's such a cool prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of me that I better do well. Take away my difficulties. What a cool thing. But not for me, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. So I say the third step prayer a lot. And I say prayers throughout the day when I'm struggling. So we learn how to pray. Then we work with others. There's where the magic happens. If I have one day a week, year, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, when I'm sitting talking to another alcoholic and they're talking to me about something's going on with them, and the program stuff comes to me, the perspective comes to me, it's about, here's my experience with that, here's what works. What character defect or character quality are we being in? What do you think it does for me? It reinforces me living in the solution. So one of the greatest gifts I've ever had is working with some guys. And I get a bunch out of it, and I hope they do too. But working with others is huge. And I know it doesn't have to be sponsorship. It can just be giving somebody a ride. It can be having a friendly ear. It can be that kind of thing. So working with others is a huge deal. And then learning how to have fun sober. That's a big one. Those that know me know I don't struggle with this. I have a ton of fun in my life. But I've run into a bunch of guys and girls that you know, they switch addictions when they get here. They become workaholics or they switch addictions, and they don't know how to have fun sober. So the suggestion has always been is to ask your friends what they do for fun. And be willing to go through the uncomfortable feeling of doing it. And a good example of this is, if you're brand new in recovery and you're real serious about doing this thing, and you were willing to go to a meeting, and if somebody suggested to me, hey, there's a great meeting, Monday night blue chip speaker meeting, you ought to come hear a good story, I would have these feelings early in recovery. I would have these feelings of, how do I find it? Is it going to be a good meeting? Are people going to be friendly? Am I going to get something out of it? All the different feelings. But because I'm willing, I walk through all those feelings and I show up at a blue chip speaker meeting, and it's a great meeting and people are friendly and there's coffee and stuff. But even the second and third time I go, I'm still going to have some of those feelings. I don't know everybody yet. How do I get to know each other? But I'm willing to walk through those feelings to get to know folks. And once I've gone 10 or 20 times, then guess what? I'm looking forward to going to the meeting. Just going to the meeting. Same thing with having fun. Learn to have fun. If I don't have anything, go find out something that sounds fun to you, and then go be willing to walk through the feelings of doing it over and over again. And then guess what? You'll be having fun. I've heard this saying I love. It says, you know, it's just more fun to have fun. So learning how to have fun sober. So those are the six things. Go to meetings, get a competent sponsor, work all 12 steps, learn to pray, work with others, and have fun sober. As I grew in recovery, and I had gone through, I call it my MAR job, my treatment center in their wisdom, I was in the commercial real estate business, and after I'd been clean for a number of months, I was ready to go back and be a grandiose commercial real estate broker. And the wisdom of my treatment center, they said, no, we want you to go get a job unrelated to your field. And so I was willing. So I went out and put, this is an example of how God can work in your lives and how willingness really matters. So I said, okay, what am I qualified to do? Nothing but commercial real estate. So I put applications at the shoe store and the restaurants and the, you name it, for over weeks and weeks of periods of time. But we get up every day. Like, my job today was finding a job, and I would go out and do this thing. No job, you know, rejection. I felt rejected, you know, and really it was, I just didn't have a job, you know. And so finally I kept willing, and I ended up getting this job at a Gorin's ice cream and sandwich shop on Chamblee Tucker Road. And so I show up there, and they give me a job, and I'm ringing in the register and waiting on customers. And there are two lessons for me. One is what the treatment center wanted me to learn. So the thing I feared the most happened the second day I was there. A lady I'd done a lease with the year before walked in, and I'm scooping ice cream. And so I did not handle it well. I went and hid the kitchen until she was gone. And then I started to think about what they wanted me to learn by taking this kind of job, and it was called humility. It's the realization that I'm no better and no worse than anybody else in this world in God's eyes, and that there is no job beneath me. A good day's work is a good day's pay. And so as I stayed there, it happened again and again. And here's the funny thing. People walked in I'd done deals with. I was ready for them. If they had said to me, what are you doing here? I'd say, I'm earning a living. And I would have been fine with it. But, you know, people didn't care. They didn't come in and say, they never asked me. They'd say, can I have some ice cream? You know, kind of thing. So here again is how God works. So remember, I didn't get all these other jobs, but I get this one. And it turns out a Chinese fella who owned a Chinese restaurant in a shopping center next door owned this freestanding building. And he would come over after his lunch rush to check on his Gorin's space, and he got to know me. And over some period of time, he came to understand what I really did for a living in commercial real estate. And so when it was time for me, when my treatment center thought I'd learned at least enough humility that I could go try my hand in my chosen field again, he said he knew what I did now. And so he said, hey, Bill, will you help me? I want to buy the shopping center that my restaurant's in. Will you help me do that? Still makes me tear up. I said I'd be absolutely happy to do that. And I did that. I went and brokered the deal for him. He bought the shopping center. I made a nice little commission, which got me started back into my chosen field. So the lesson in this for me was, if I'd gotten the first job, the second job, the 10th job, the 20th job, I wouldn't have gotten the job that God wanted me to have. So if you're struggling with that, take something from it. So I get back into my real estate business, and I'm past broke. I'm not just broke. I am past broke, okay? I'm sitting back. My partners, for some reason, by the grace of God, took me back. I'm sitting in an office at 4 o'clock my first or second day back. I'm looking out the window. I've done everything I can do that day to try to start my business back up, and I'm feeling the weight of all this money that I owe. I owe tens of thousands of dollars that I could not bankrupt. I went through bankruptcy and recovery, but I could not bankrupt all this money, and I was making me miserable. So you know what I did? Anybody know? I called my sponsor. Imagine that. I'm in trouble. I'm struggling. What do? We don't wait to figure it out and then call our sponsor. We call our sponsor. So I called my sponsor, and I said, he said, what's going on? I said, I'm miserable. He said, why? I said, because I owe all this money I can't pay back, and I don't know how in the world I'm ever going to pay it back. And he went on to explain this tool, which I call the second most useful tool in recovery behind prayer, and it's called learning how not to project. The definition is this: when I'm projecting my thinking into the future or into the past, worried about something I can do nothing about at this moment, is called projection. It is a useless, harmful exercise. It has no possibility of making things better and every possibility of making things worse. There is a difference between planning and projecting. Planning is a good thing. So he went on to explain that to me. He says, and what gave me the willingness and the ability to grasp what he was saying was when he said this to me. He said, Bill, does all the worrying in the world right this moment have any possibility of making things better about this situation? I said, no. So it proved to me that it was a useless, harmful exercise. The difference between planning and projecting, he said, in this case, pull out a piece of paper, write down a name and a number, amount of money you owe to each and every person that adds up to the total, then prioritize it, and then stick it in the drawer of your desk and let it go until you make a commission. Another way to explain this is if hypothetically I get arrested today and I've got to go to court in a week, I am worried to death about, I'm going to go, projection is I'm already in jail, I've already been sentenced, it's going to be bad. So on. So the planning part is, what can I do right this moment that will have a positive effect on the outcome? I can hire an attorney. I can call them up right now and say, "Here's, please represent me." But projection would be then to worry every single day for the next 6 days. I'm going to jail, I'm going to jail, I'm going to jail. What that does is it takes me out of those 6 days, ruins them. I don't enjoy those days. I don't make good use of those days. I just feel miserable for no reason. And here's the irony of all this, that 99.999% of things that I project about never turn out like I think they're going to. As long as I'm doing what I'm supposed to do in this program, miracles happen all the time. It is very regular in my experience to be working with a guy who has exactly that experience, and they go to court and things work out. So what I did with so learning how not to project is, it's the hardest tool to practice too, because I'm the first to admit, even after I've been practicing it for quite a while now, there are still times when I go, "This one's different. This is going to be bad." But what I've come to find, guess what? It's exactly the same stuff. It's my disease talking to me, trying to get me in a place where I'm going to go drink or use again. And again, it always works out if I do what I'm supposed to do. So, learning how not to project is a huge deal. My sponsor had me do this. He said, "Bill, this is one thing I want you to overdo. I want you to overdo much, but I want you to overdo this." He said, "Start taking a look at your thinking on a moment-by-moment basis for the next extended period of time and look for projection." And what I found, I did that, and what I found was that 90-something percent of my thinking was out here or back here. It was not what's right in front of me to do right now. So I call it the redirecting my thinking right back here, right here, right now. And if, in like a using thought, when I catch myself projecting, I call it the 5-second rule, but because I'm extra special, we make it the 3-second rule. If it keeps coming back, the best solution, best tool I've ever heard of, is to pick up the phone, call somebody else, ask them how they're doing, and be genuinely interested. Get out of me. Because when I'm sitting in this stuff, I'm sitting in self. I'm sitting in the problem. So, I suggest you take a look at projection. It's made my life immeasurably better. And then what it's like now. I told you all about the 3 marriages that I burned down. Well, here is the... So I'm... When I first started getting sober, I was past broke, filed bankruptcy, facing the loss of a professional license. My third wife had left me. My life, you would think, was over. Well, guess what? I suited up, showed up here, did the 6 things that we've been talking about. And over time, 2 years clean, I met a girl, and I've been very happily married for 22 years now. And here's the funny part. So she's Greek, and I don't know if y'all know any Greeks, but her dad is definitely Greek. And I was able to, at some point, after I kind of won them over, sit down with them and say, you know, ask for her hand in marriage. I said, you know, his name was George. I said, "George, you know, I love your daughter. I'd like for your blessing hand in marriage, but you need to know I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. And I've been divorced 3 times." I was able to say that to them, and then it was a shock. But they got over it very quickly, and then they came to love me. I felt for part of their family in a big way since then. So no matter what you're facing in early recovery or late recovery, middle recovery, we can walk through this stuff if we use the people in the program, the higher power, and the tools that we learn here by working the 12 step. I started applying those principles to my business, the commercial real estate business I told you I was so worried about. And over a period of 20 years, I was able to grow into a very successful business, and I was able to retire very, very comfortably in 2017. That's one of those things you can't get here from there. That's an example of what this program can do. So I walk around today. I want to be very careful. The guys that know me, I, I talk a lot of solution, and I don't talk a lot about troubles I have, and here's the reason why. I really don't struggle very much. But I do have stuff happen. I'm a real guy. I have real life stuff that happens. But today I have tools to know how to go through them. They're still uncomfortable. Again, I call them zingers, things that happen, don't feel good. But I have tools today to go through them. And there's not a reason in the world I have to use over any of it. There's people have gone through deaths, sickness, whatever, and we don't have to use over. So I'll close with this: is that I feel like that definition that I gave you earlier, that I have a disease that is fatal in nature, but when I've done what we do here, I've come out better than I ever would have if I had never had the disease. When I talk to people that are friends of mine, and I add this, that the whole purpose of getting sober is not to hang out only in these rooms with only recovering people. The whole point of getting sober is to get out and live life. So I'll leave you with that: if you do this thing the way it's laid out in the book, and you make it the most important thing you do, then you'll get this thing. The only people who cannot get sober are people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And the only people I've ever met or heard about that were not constitutionally capable of being honest with themselves were so damaged that they just couldn't ask themselves that question. So if you can ask yourself the question, can I be honest with myself? You can be honest with yourself. And so if you get serious about this and get that good sponsor and get through the steps, you can have a life that's better than you ever thought. And I will close with this. There are friends of mine out there that are not in the program, and I get to know them, become very close friends with them. And there have been occasions when they want to know more, and I'll actually say to them, I'm grateful I'm a drug addict and alcoholic, and they'll look at me like I'm crazy. And I'll explain to them just what I just explained to you, that if I had not been, I would have been a guy bouncing off of life with my character defects, not knowing how to deal with life, and I would have gone through my whole life that way. But because I came in here and did the six things, I have a set of tools that I have a life, as I said earlier, way beyond my wildest dreams. So, Tim, thanks for asking me to do this, and thank you for your time and listening.
Well, that was great. So many great tools of recovery, and I'll tell a funny story real briefly. You mentioned the tool of calling your sponsor when it's not evident to do that, and there's so many coincidences in recovery that there must be God instances instead. And I remember I was struggling in my work, had a really terrible day at business, and driving out to my studio out in Tucker, Georgia, and I was going by the strip mall out there, and you mentioned your job is in commercial real estate, and I'm really struggling. I'm all up in my head, and I look over at a vacant office building, and there's a sign on it that said, "Call Bill Barnes." And what a coincidence. So I called him, but I couldn't have figured that out on my own. So the longer I'm sober, the more I see the tools placed in front of me. But anyway, Julie made me tell that story, so I'm going to let her pass out the chips.
Julian, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for that, Bill. We have a lot of the same philosophies about what happened to us and what it means to be a recovering person, recovered alcoholic. We have a chip system here at the Blue Chip Speakers Meeting that marks our time in sobriety. And it goes like this. We have a white chip, come into our way of life or come back after some experimentation. Does anybody want a white chip? We have a silver chip for 30 days. All right. Anybody else need 30-day chip? we have added this fancy gold one for 60 days. Anybody have 60? Yes! Yeah. Anybody else for 60 days? Red for 90? Yellow for 6 months? Green for 9 months? Any birthdays?
My name's Robert Bell. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, it's
been 18 years. And thank you, Bill, for telling your story. And the things he said hold so true for me. It's always great to hear Bill talk and tell his story. It's great to be around him. But I think the way that I did, in my home group, we have a tradition. We sort of say briefly in a succinct way what's happened to me. And I've tried to find out and become a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. What that means to me is to have a sponsor. I'm being transparent to my sponsors. I sponsor other guys. I'm willing to help guys when they ask for help. I'm a member of a home group, and I'm active in my home group. I take service positions there, and I take other service positions in other areas of Alcoholics Anonymous when asked. I also try and be of service in other areas of my life beyond Alcoholics Anonymous. Sort of like Bill said, you got to do stuff besides just AA. And I try and do the things that I've been asked to do. It might be at work. It might be at home. I try to be a good husband. I try to be a good employee for the people that I may boss around. I try and be a good boss for them, too. When I put all these things together, somehow it just makes it really easy to stay sober. But the most important thing is I did have to come here, take the 12 steps, and develop a relationship with a higher power. And I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks.
Any other birthdays? I'm going to offer this white chip one more time in case you changed your mind about it. Anybody want a white chip? All right, I'll leave it up here if you want to come up here and take it.
All right, good stuff. I remind each of the anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.